Hi, I'm Ashama Bailey, and you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, Bomb Squad. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Each week, we talk to the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. Let's thank our sponsor, Hansenbrook Farm Pasture-Raised Organic Eggs. Hansenbrook Farm's secret to making rich, flavorful eggs is simple. The most possible space, the best possible feed, and lots of love. It's a healthy and humane recipe that makes your omelets, cakes, custards, and everything in between taste better. Get cracking at hansenbrookfarm.com. All right, it's time for some housekeeping. Radio Cherry Bomb is coming to a city near you. The Food for Thought tour is underway. We had a lovely stop in Savannah this week at Cheryl Day's Back in the Day Bakery. So many members of the Bomb Squad came in from out of town, including our pals at Camp Craft Cocktail and 1748 Bakehouse. Next up is Baltimore on Tuesday the 11th, Phoenix on June 25th, and San Diego on July 8th. We'd love to see all of you at these events. Tickets are available at cherrybomb.com. And big thanks to Kerrygold for supporting our tour. Don't forget, our Cone Only initiative is underway. It's in partnership with the folks at Surfrider NYC and the Surfrider Long Island chapters. If you're getting ice cream this summer, make sure to skip the cup and skip the spoon. Go Cone Only for a more sustainable summer. Also, our new issue featuring cover girl Samin Nosrat of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat is almost here. You can snag an issue through cherrybomb.com or visit your favorite book or magazine shop, including Omnivore Books in San Francisco and the Paris Market in Savannah. Now on to today's episode. I had the privilege of sitting down with Gabriela Camara, the chef, author, and activist behind restaurants like Contramar in Mexico City, Kala in San Francisco, and the upcoming Onda in Los Angeles that Gabriela is opening with Jessica Coslow from Squirrel. Gabriela's first cookbook, My Mexico City Kitchen, is out right now, and it's a beautiful compilation of her recipes and convictions, as the subtitle says. Gabriela is a force for change, and we're so glad she's part of the Bomb Squad. Before we get to my conversation with Gabriela Camara, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Hansenbrook Farm believes that organic and pastured is the way to go when it comes to eggs. Pasture-raised means better lives for hens, better lives for small farmers, and better eggs for you. It's also better for the chefs who depend on rich, flavorful eggs. Hansenbrook Farm's own flock of amazing chefs, their mother hens, count on it. Janine Booth is a mother hen. She's the Australian chef behind the Southern-inspired Root and Bone restaurants in New York City and Miami. Want to learn how Chef Janine makes her sweet corn spoon bread? The ingredients include Hansenbrook Farm eggs, some scallions, sharp cheddar cheese, and a touch of heavy cream. You can find Chef Janine's delicious egg-centric recipes and videos on hansenbrookfarm.com. Where can you find Hansenbrook Farm organic pasture-raised eggs? At Publix, Kroger, Sprouts Farmers Market, Fresh Direct, and many natural food stores across the country. Enjoy my chat with Gabriela Camara. Did you have 800 people at your wedding?
I did.
Because I read that in the book and I was like, some of the local women you knew very well growing up made mole.
Yes.
And you said made mole for 800 people. And I was like, wait, what?
Yes. Yes.
It's like a royal wedding.
No, but it was a wedding in the town. And in towns, you know, small towns, people just, everybody's invited. So everybody shows up and it's just, that's the way it is. And I think formally we had like 500-600, which was still big. But then people were just invited and they come along with their families. And that's, and it's a very traditional town where people live in neighborhoods that are called barrios. And they're, all the barrios have different festivities depending on the religious figure that their church has. And the day of the party of the barrio, the houses are open. They make mole for 1,000 people each house, and people just go from house to house eating the different moles that the mostly ladies prepare.
That's beautiful.
It's a very communal sort of inclusive culture that is open to everybody.
What town did you grow up in?
I grew up in Tepoztlán, in the state of Morelos, south of Mexico City.
Okay. So one thing I could not find in the book is yeah. how did you make the jump from studying art and history to being a chef?
I was studying history. I wanted to be a curator of contemporary art. I just always envisioned myself as an academic because that's what my parents were and that's what sort of my world was. And in Mexico, you have to go into a subject right after high school. It's not, you don't go to college and then sort of get to choose from here and there. So I thought, okay, I was having a real struggle in what I should study. And I decided that history was sort of a general thing that appealed to me on many different levels, and you know, a lot of philosophy and literature. And it was sort of my middle ground of not going to college because I knew I wanted to study in Mexico. I distinctly did not want to come to the States to study because I really wanted to be Mexican in a sort of, I just wanted to go to university there. And while I was studying, we just came up with the idea of this restaurant. And this restaurant became Contramar. This restaurant was this huge warehouse where we started making this amazing seafood with the Pacific coastal influence, but also like very Italian in its purity and simplicity. And it's now clear to me that it is this, because when we opened it, it was just what we did, right? And this other friend I opened it with was also Italian, and also he didn't want to live in Italy, came back to Mexico. And so it sort of made sense. Many times we'd said, oh, let's make a restaurant. But then
let me just interrupt one second. You are half Italian, half Mexican, which not everyone realizes.
Yes, my mom is Italian. And anyways, we would always say, oh yeah, we should have this in Mexico City. What a shame we can't eat this in Mexico City. And one Christmas he said, you know what, I'm ready to come back to Mexico. Let's just do this. Because I was 21, 22 when we actually opened. And I was in the middle of university. I had a career. I was a really good student. I was assisting this amazing art historian. I really my career had a path. Like I was onto something. But I had this boyfriend who then I married, who had a cafe and sort of was in that world in a way that none of us were. So he sort of pushed us to doing this, which I will always be thankful for, because I really think otherwise I would have never come to this craziness of opening restaurants. But anyways, we did it and it was so much fun and I enjoyed the process so much, and I kept on working I was doing an internship at the National Museum of Art, and I was still finishing. I was very much into being a good student and I really enjoyed what I was doing. And we opened Contramar and it sort of didn't take over immediately, but it did take over a lot of my interests, or it really did cover a lot of my interests.
Were you cooking in the beginning? Were you like hosting?
No, it was really interesting because I was like always overseeing everything and like making sure that, oh yeah, these chairs and this painting and this, and like my uncle made the mural. And like I was sort of in the process of figuring everything out. And it was very clear on things that I wanted that I really now don't even know where it came from. I was very clear that I wanted waiters that were professional waiters. I didn't want like cool servers with, you know,
hipsters.
Piercings. And yes, because that was happening and I knew I didn't want that. I wanted serious servers. I wanted tablecloths. I wanted, even if it was a very simple restaurant, I wanted food to be taken seriously at it. So I didn't want people to go because it was a cool place, but I wanted people to go because it was good food. Because if you ask me now, I think that's the perfect motivation to make a restaurant. But then I had no idea. You know, I liked going to restaurants.
The story's crazy.
I know.
I mean, Contramar really is now one of the most important restaurants around. It's 20 years old, which is remarkable.
It'll be 21 this year.
You were a baby when you opened it. Yes. And it's still so relevant and important and changed the restaurant scene.
Mm-hmm. I know.
It's crazy. But I want to know, when did someone like grab you and say, okay, you need to scale this fish. You need to cut this and make some ceviche. You need to do all
this. No, because in Mexico also the really cool thing is we found these people that knew how to do it. Mm-hmm. We got this kid from the beach that in the place that we would always, you know, eat the fish. He came to the city. He showed us how to do it. Federico, the guy that I opened, the friend that I opened Contramar with, was an amazing cook. He is an amazing cook. And so he was really onto the part of the kitchen. And I would come back from my job at downtown Mexico City from the National Museum of Art. And I would come in the afternoons and just sort of half wait tables, half serve things, half make new dishes in the afternoon with him, half, you know, expand the menu, make desserts. It was crazy. Really so experimental. It was not like we had no idea what we were onto. And I just started, I started taking it really seriously after I made a deal with my partners, because I was still studying. And then I got this grant to come and do and finish my dissertation here in New York, because I was, my dissertation was on the political uses of art. And I was very interested in two exhibitions that had happened here, in one at the Museum of Modern Art in 1938 or 1940.
What was the exhibition?
It was 20 centuries of Mexican art. And then one in 1991 at the Met, which was 30 centuries of Mexican art. So I thought it was very interesting that in 80 years they had added another, you know, 10 centuries from 20 centuries to 30 centuries. But it was all like in these very important political moments of Mexican history and art. And anyways, so I made a deal with them and I said, okay, I'm going to go to New York. I got this scholarship. I'm going to go to New York for 6 months and then I'll come back and I'll take care of the restaurant on my own for I don't know what period. And when I started taking care of the restaurant just thrived. And I, like, everything, we had all these debts that I had no idea about. And I just started getting it all into, like, into shape. And I really loved it. I loved every aspect of it because I loved the social part of it. I love the challenge of learning about accounting and bookkeeping. And I love the part of actually then having to figure out how to run a kitchen smartly. And I learned about how, you know, how to deal with a staff. And in Mexico, it was mostly a staff of men from really rough backgrounds that, of course, did not give a shit about what this white 23-year-old idiot girl was telling them. So I was, it was really, I mean, and I, as I, you know, I think one of my biggest assets, I think, is that I grew up in a small town. And in a small town that was, it wasn't like hipster Mexico City. It was very traditional, very, you know, it was, it's a town that has been very proud of their Aztec ancestry. And they were very like Zapatistas. And then 94, they were totally pro the Zapatista movement. So it was very sort of a very traditional town. And they have opposed all these impositions from the government, and they like they're a very, very strong town. So I was comfortable dealing with all sorts of people. I wasn't only comfortable dealing with like white, educated, European looking Mexicans, which are a piece of work. And they are mainly like our, I think, our like top consumers at Contramar. They are, if you go to Contramar, it is varied, like it is a varied public, but it is very much, you know, as the Mexican society is in the city, if the mostly like European looking people are the ones that have the resources to hop around and go to cool places and spend money. So I have, you know, in a restaurant, you have to deal with these obnoxious clients, but you also have to deal with the staff that you have and these people that have, you know, that have had rough lives or that have, you know, they've had to migrate to the city just as they've had to migrate to the United States because the city wasn't enough, or they knew somebody in Tennessee. And for them, going to Tennessee or going to Mexico City is sort of the same thing, you know. Or you know that LA is the second city with most Mexicans?
Really?
After Mexico City.
Wow.
Isn't that impressive?
Yeah.
I mean, LA is...
That doesn't surprise me, though.
I know.
Yeah.
But it has more Mexicans than Monterrey. It has more Mexicans than Guadalajara. I mean, it's... LA is packed with Mexicans. The point is, I sort of, the restaurant gave me a platform that I didn't even know was so perfect for me. And I just, you know, I thrived because I had all these people that I knew that would come to the restaurant and that then would just, you know, make the restaurant a cool place. And
it's amazing how it all came together.
Yes.
And I wonder now, can young people do the same thing? They can't in San Francisco.
They can't in San Francisco for sure.
No.
I miss Mexico City so much in that possibility that exists, you know, that a city where you feel that things can happen. And that's why so many people are moving down there. But I also think that Mexico City has changed. I mean, this was almost 21 years ago.
Yeah.
And Mexico City, I do think, is still much more vibrant and lively than rich or important cities in the United States. there's still room for doing things. I think there's much more room for experimentation. If I tell you how, you know, just with how little we made Contramar. And I think of, you know, opening a restaurant in New York nowadays, like you couldn't open a restaurant just like experimentally. Let's, you know, you could do a pop-up here or there or whatever, but to actually have a restaurant that is an establishment or that is trying to do serious food, it's you need to be a real professional. You need to have real money to back it up. I mean, it's really...
Yeah. It's, I hope somewhere in this country, in this planet, we have listeners all over the world, there's that spirit of, you know, we can just do this and make it happen. You know, people who are young and kind of spunky and want to do a cool thing reflective of them and their friends.
Yeah. You know, I think a really important thing that was relevant to Contramar was that the food was actually really good and it wasn't pretentious. And we really just wanted, and I think there have been very good examples of experiments like that in the world in general, many times done by artists that are really passionate about, you know, conveying something to their friends, to their community. But many times I think what happens is that they don't have the discipline or the person that can actually make it become an institution or make it become something that is financially viable. And I really, like, this is no merit of mine. This is just something that I found I had. You know, this is just something that fortunately happened, but could have not happened. And then Contramar could have been like a cool place that lasted 3 years. Who knows?
At what point did you realize you were a good chef?
You know what? I think I'm a better eater than a chef. And I'm a good chef because I'm a good eater. I do what I think will be good. And I have a very good, like I have a very good knack or very acute sense of seasoning. So I'm very good at thinking about ingredients together, which I guess makes me a good chef. But I always think...
I was going to say, I'm a good eater, but I would not call myself a good chef.
No, but I guess I always think that, and it sounds super pretentious, and I don't think I've ever said it this way, but I guess I have I have good taste, or whatever is considered good taste in this environment. Because, I mean, good taste is so relative.
I get the sense you don't like calling yourself a chef. Is that what's going on?
I just have so much respect for people who are chefs and who do study to be a chef or who have gone up in the ranks of like starting as a dishwasher. And I just like had a restaurant one day. So it feels like a total.
You cut the line.
Yeah, I totally did.
So has Contramar changed much over the years menu-wise?
I think it's improved, but I don't think it's changed greatly. But I do think it's improved. I think it's become more radical in that, you know, only local fish and only line caught fish and only fish that has been caught by this community of people that will ensure that the species can keep on growing and all this. And I think we always strive at doing things better. But I think the idea was there from the beginning. And I was, as I said, you know, my mother's Italian, and she's a great cook, but she wasn't particularly into cooking. I mean, she's of that generation that, you know, she had a PhD and she wanted to be...
I got the sense it wasn't very feminist to be in the kitchen for your mother's...
No. Like, she was into other things, and if the household chores had to be sacrificed, well, fine. Thankfully, she got herself a really good husband that was the most supportive of her, of us, of everybody.
Your dad made breakfast
for you.
What
did he make?
Which
was a really weird thing for Mexico. Now I think many, like most people, most guys in my generation make breakfast for them, for their partners, for their kids, and it's not a surprise. But believe me, when I was growing up in Tepoztlán, nobody could believe that my father was cooking. Nobody. And he's always been a really good cook.
What was he making? I'm dying to know.
He was making everything. He's a really good eater too. And his mother was an amazing cook. And his sisters are amazing cooks. And they're from a part of Mexico from the southeast. And it's really good food. Sort of Campeche, which is like Yucatecan food. And my grandfather was from Tabasco. So it's that food from that part of the country, which is really sophisticated and rich and... not as well known as Oaxacan food, but really, really refined and incredible. Anyways, He was making, I don't know, he was making scrambled, he was making anything that we wanted. It was also, my parents were very liberated people. So, you know, we had cookbooks and we could study something and make it. Like, there was no limit to what one could make if you wanted to make it. Not that we would like have like fancy Farsi breakfast one day, but if there was something that we wanted to try, we would experiment with it. And cooking was fun, and it was half learning, half what you already did know in tradition and what you had around you.
And I read you were the tortilla maker in the house.
I was, because I was mortified that my mother didn't make tortillas. There was nobody making fresh tortillas in my house. And all the kids I went to school with had fresh tortillas because either their grandmothers or their mothers were making them. Anyways, and I was always very curious about food. I really always did love eating. And I remember asking Victoria, the woman who helped us around the house, to teach me. And she had no patience for, you know, a young girl. Because this is something you grow into. In a town like that, you just, like, one day you're old enough that you have to start making the tortillas. But if you're a kid, they don't need you around the kitchen. You're a bother in a kitchen. So I was always very attentive to Victoria. And one day she actually let me start making tortillas. And then since that day, I'm the only person in my house that knows how to make tortillas. Making tortillas is really difficult, actually.
Are you amazed more and more people are trying to make tortillas at home?
I love it. I love it because I actually think that there's nothing as good as a fresh tortilla. And even if, and I think I do talk about this in my book. It's, I know that, you know, traditional cooks will tell you that there's no equivalent to fresh nixtamal made with good heirloom, amazing corn and limestone. That there's no equivalent to that. But actually, masarina, organic corn, masarina is a very good substitute, and it's something you could do at home, and you have a little bit of powder. You do a cup of that with water, and you can make your own fresh tortillas instead of grinding your own corn, like putting it to boil and then cooking it with a limestone and then bring it to the mill. I mean, that's something that you do, you know. Mills in Mexico are sort of what ovens were in French towns. Everybody would make their own bread, but then would go bake it at the communal oven, which was the challenging part to have individually. And that's what a molino used to be. And then people would go bring their corn. The corn was ground. You had your masa, and then you would have your tortillas or whatever you wanted to make with your corn for the rest of the day. But it's sort of a system that is part of a culture.
Grab your notebooks, Bomb Squad. We're going back to school this summer with a new podcast miniseries, Cherry Bomb University. Each week, we'll be offering crash courses taught by your favorite members of the Bomb Squad to get you cooking, eating, and thinking like the smart cookie you are. Thank you to Le Cordon Bleu for making the series possible. You can learn more about Le Cordon Bleu at cordonbleu.edu. Now back to my conversation with Gabriella. You did suggest having a tortilla press at home.
No, totally. Because as I was saying, you can get the organic masarina, and you have more and more options of that, thankfully, because of the interest in heirloom corn and crops that we have to keep in protecting. And then you can just add water. And if you have a tortilla press and a hot pan, it doesn't even have to be a sophisticated comal.
Right, you said you could just have a cast iron.
Yes.
Pan. Yeah.
And you make a fresh tortilla, and it is so different from anything you will find in the markets.
Well, I confess I've never made a fresh tortilla, but after this I am going
to try. And be very careful of, you need to be following instructions, because it sounds very easy, but you have to be very careful of when you turn them.
Okay.
Because the key is how to turn the tortilla. So you press it. You first have to make sure that the consistency is sticky enough that it isn't, you know, all separate and like the dough is like sticks together, but also loose enough that it actually does make a tortilla. But you need to make sure that it doesn't have so much water that you can't take it from the plastic without it breaking. So it's, you put two pieces of plastic, you put the little ball of dough, like an ounce, you put the other piece of plastic, you press it, you make sure that it's evenly flattened. And I would recommend starting with not very thin tortillas, because they're easier to cook. So then you just take the first plastic off. It has to peel easily. If it's too wet, it won't. And then you take it out with your hand, it sticks to your hand, and then you put it onto a very hot pan or comal or...
Is it oiled?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. And then as soon as it starts getting opaque at the top, you need to turn it because it needs to keep on cooking and not drying out. So you need to turn it, and it will turn. Like, you will be able to turn it. And if you don't want to use your fingers because it's too hot and it's something that you sort of need to be used to, you use a little
spatula or something.
Yeah, you turn it. And then that's when it cooks the most.
Okay.
And then when it starts puffing a little bit, you turn it around, and that's when it puffs out.
Okay.
And when it puffs up is when it's
done. All right. We're gonna make this happen.
Yes.
Given that your mom is Italian, your dad is Mexican, were there any interesting culinary mashups
home? Yes. Like fresh pasta with leftover mole, which is my favorite. Like the two comfort foods of the world.
There was an article in the Times even about Mexican food in Africa. It's amazing to
Mexican
see it traveling
food,
the globe.
I know.
Yeah.
Because it's also really easy, even if it's, this is something that we should actually look more into, but I think that cheap Mexican food travels so well that I think it can be accessible to many people.
So yeah, the Times did a piece on called Nairobi Embraces Its Mexican Soul. I mean, it's fascinating
yes,
to see Mexican
it is really
food
fascinating.
Around the globe
It is
now.
Really fascinating.
Yeah.
The only thing I would say is I think we should just be mindful of the quality of the food.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think that a lot of what we consider Mexican food is really bad food in general.
Well, I think that's what's interesting about the book, too. It's the book is so beautiful. Some people might be intimidated, but when you go through the recipes, there's just a lot of beautiful, basic things. So, mm-hmm. like, it's such mm-hmm. a good introduction to Mexican food, the salsas, mm-hmm. everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really wanted to make something that was not just a beautiful object, but mm-hmm. something that people could use.
Yes. It feels like a cookbook you can 100% work your way
good.
Through.
Good. Another amazing thing you can... I love that you see it that way, because that's exactly what I wanted to.
There's so much good practical stuff in here, like why white onion is more popular.
Uh-huh.
And so many of your recipes call for white onion.
Exactly. Which is, I mean, you could use yellow, purple, other onions, but it just... Or fresh onions, or... It's just that's what is more widely accessible in Mexico. Yeah.
And then you bust some myths about chilies and removing the seeds.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, I think there's, you know, everybody thinks that chiles are spicy because of the seeds, and they are, I mean, the seeds are spicy, but a lot of the spice is also in the veins of the chile. So if you remove the seeds and don't remove the veins, the chile is still going to be very, very spicy.
The cover is so beautiful and so colorful. You also have a little love letter to limes.
Well, you know, when we were shooting the first pictures of the book,
mm-hmm.
Lorena Jones, the editor, who is extraordinary, was calling me and saying, Gabriela, why are there limes in every picture? And it really made me realize how in Mexico we use limes for everything. And we were shooting in Mexico City. I came back to San Francisco and I met with Lorena and I said, Lorena, you really have to go to Mexico, but you're not going to believe it. In Mexico, we use limes for everything. You know, you go to a restaurant and they bring sort of a bowl of limes for you to add on to any taco or to anything that you're eating. You know how here you get a taco and it has a little slice of a In Mexico, you actually get limes with everything. And then we shot this picture, and I really, like, it grew on me because it really represents something that I really appreciate about Mexican food. And not only the limes, but, like, the freshness and the being able to finish up your dish the way you want to eat it. Like, adding lime, adding salt, adding sauces. In Mexico, you always have sauces, and you do whatever a lot of the way we eat has to do with finishing up the dishes like to our own taste, to each person's taste. So I think the limes represent that.
It also represents it to me sort of the color and the vibrancy of Mexico City.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So
and
so
you
beautiful.
Were just there, so you know how vibrant that city is.
So you're doing Onda with our friend Jessica
yes.
from Squirrel.
Yes.
How did you two hook up to do a project?
We hooked up to do a project because we've liked each other for a long time, and we did a few things. Jessica did a pop-up at Contramar, and then she cooked like Contramar inspired items for one brunch at Squirrel last year, and then she was asked to do this restaurant at the Proper Hotel in Santa Monica, and she thought making something with me would be fun. And I think she really wants to collaborate with somebody that can be like a colleague for her. Like, I think there's this real need for people in every industry, but in our industry, to have more dialogue with. There's a need to be more in touch with other people, and there's a need to be more aware of what other people are doing, not just to be like up to date with discoveries or new ingredients or new techniques, but just in terms of like camaraderie of, you know, just being colleagues and understanding how one does this or how one does the other. I don't know. We met during this conference in Copenhagen at MAD, and her husband came to me and he said, "Oh my goodness, Jessica needs, like, you and Jessica are going to be such good friends. You need to meet each other." And we did it. We really liked each other. And it's been a challenge because I have been busier than ever. And last year I was invited to start working with a new president of Mexico who went into office this last December. So I'm sort of like putting my every bit of life together so that I can go and
to do what?
So I was invited to be the head of this board. It's a board for the promotion of tourism. And I was invited to do that right after he was elected. And there's in Mexican politics, I don't know why, but there's a really long period of transition. So the new president is elected in July, early July, and then goes into office early December. So there are 6 months of transition period, which is basically where all the fraudulent things are solved or like put together or covered so that the next president starts clean. Anyways, in this period, I started looking into this board, and this board basically gets $25 from each person who travels by plane into Mexico, any part of the country. So it's a lot of money. Anyways, I started looking into this, and of course, I mean, I really believe that Mexico needs a new political leadership. I really do believe that this guy is very good on many grounds. I trust him. He is not corrupt, and it is very important for Mexico to not have a corrupt president for the first time in who knows when. And I really want to help him. So I said, okay, let's start looking into this. And this apparatus was a huge office. And I started, you know, I really one day said, this is made to steal money. This is an office that was set up long before social media and internet and the accessibility to information that we have now. So you could actually promote a country very smartly nowadays with 10 good people and agencies here and there that you would hire, or not even, you probably don't even need that.
Yeah.
And this was an office of 250 people, more than 300 external contractors, 21 international offices. And I told the president, we need to shut this down, because all this money that you want to use for the Mayan train, because there's this project of a Mayan train, is going to come from this board. So there's no reason to keep the board as it is. We need to do something more flexible, more agile, whatever. Anyway, so I shut down this thing that I was going to direct. And after that, he just said, you know, I okay, fine. So I was like, great, I'm done. I can go back to doing my things. No. And he was like, no, I want you as an advisor.
Wow. So that's a big deal.
I know.
You're an advisor to the president.
It's a big deal. And it hasn't started officially because I still have all this going on that I can't just drop. But I will go back to living in Mexico, and I will start doing whatever I can to help him be a better president. And I will do everything that I can to, you know, to sort of enforce food policies that we know are better for the world. Mexico has a huge health problem that has to do with food, ironically, being, you know, the country or the geographical area of where corn is from, and tomatoes and squash and beet and so many things. And we have the second largest population with child obesity. And I really believe that eating well can make a huge difference. I mean, it's not that I believe it. We know that eating well can really make a difference in people's lives. And having, you know, sustainable agricultural and farming practices. And with industrial agriculture, it's really gone down the drain. Bad. We've taken the worst from the United States. Yeah. I'm sorry to say.
No.
Anyways, I
know.
I do look forward to going back to Mexico, and I don't know in what capacity I will work with the president, because he wants me to work with him. I've told him, okay, I need to just go finish doing my book thing, and then we'll figure out what exactly it is I will do.
Gosh, you need to clone yourself.
I know.
Oh my God.
But I have hired an executive chef for the first time ever, which is amazing.
For which restaurant?
For everything.
Okay. Okay. When can we expect Onda to open?
Onda is going to open this summer.
Okay. So excited.
July. It's scheduled for July, and it's, you know, it's in the proper hotel, so it's a very serious project.
Okay.
They're opening.
Mark your calendars, everybody. July in Los Angeles.
Yeah, July in Los Angeles. Yeah.
Who are your role models in food?
It's so classic that I'm sort of embarrassed, but Diana Kennedy, mm-hmm. Alice Waters, mm-hmm. my grandmothers, people who cook in practical ways, people who have to cook every day for a family, people who have to cook every day for their office, people who actually cook because they, yes, have to do it, but also really enjoy it and do it in a way that is smart and practical and sustainable. And
I only ask because hearing you talk about all the things that you want to do mm-hmm. for Mexico, mm-hmm. for an entire country, mm-hmm. an entire population of people, you know, Jose Andres comes to mind.
Oh my goodness, I admire him so much, and I love him.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we always talk about how food can change lives and change the world, and I think now we're really seeing it.
Totally.
I mean, he was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize.
I know, and he totally should get it.
Yeah.
He totally should get it.
Yeah.
Because he really has brought attention to food in a way that has gone beyond. And I saw Jose Andres for the first time in a food conference in Spain, maybe 15 years ago, in a Madrid Fusion, which is this, like, you know, it was all about molecular gastronomy. You know, Ferran Adrià, Juan Mari Arzak, Jose Andres, Thomas Keller, and Charlie Trotter were the two, like, American guests. And it was all about, you know, super, super, super high-end, sophisticated, technically challenging cuisine, and Jose Andres took it to this level of social justice, which I think
15 years ago.
But he, wow. 15 years ago, he wasn't even into this. He was part of this, you know, group of fancy Spanish chefs, all these guys, of course, not one woman. It didn't even occur to me that that was an issue, right? And when Juan Mari's, you know, daughter Elena was around, it was like, oh, great, it was the daughter. So bad. It was, you know, we were all these women working for them, with them, around them, but not the stars ever. Anyways, I really think that the United States gives people who want to see an amazing perspective and an amazing opportunity to make change in a way that other countries don't sort of establish it in such a straightforward way. For example, in Mexico, you can do many things, and you can do many things very well. But in the United States, you have clear paths of being able to create change, and the change being impactful, because you have all these NGOs that actually are already doing things for immigrants, things for people in conditions. I mean, I guess it's because it's a country with more resources. But I've spoken about this with Jose Andres, and when he came to the United States, this awareness of how much he could do for this population of immigrants who he was hiring, and every restaurateur was hiring, and every chef, you know, in New York, everybody had to learn Spanish because you had people from Puebla working here. And none of them actually were making a statement or thinking of how to make that better. And I think Jose Andres was both for circumstances of his own, like, incredible being, but also because he was sort of forced into thinking and actually acting on these issues, that he became very aware of his power as a public figure and of his power as such a fancy or recognized chef. And I think he's such an inspiration. I really, really, really love him. I think he's wonderful.
On the topic of Jose and you looking up to him and all the things that you're doing, I think it's so wonderful and so important, because the whole point of representation, you know, we had a young chef here the other day, Kia Damone, uh-huh. who's cooking at Lolito. Uh-huh. And I was talking about how Jody Adams, chef from Boston, always said, if you can't see it, you can't be it. Uh-huh. And she was saying, exactly. And there aren't a ton of Jose Andres level women for women in this industry to look up to. So I'm really happy to hear about what you're doing. You could easily just kick back and make beautiful food, but instead you're trying to make the world a more beautiful place. And you're really a role model for all of us.
I mean, I hope to do more, but
I hope you can.
I'm very honored that you think I'm a good role model.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much to Gabriella for speaking with me. Be sure to check out her brand new cookbook, My Mexico City Kitchen. And if you find yourself in San Francisco, Mexico City, or Los Angeles this summer, try to go to one of her wonderful restaurants. Thank you to our sponsor, Hansenbrook Farm Pasture-Raised Organic Eggs, for supporting this season of Radio Cherry Bomb. You folks are excellent. Radio Cherry Bomb is a production of Cherry Bomb Media. Our show is edited, engineered, and produced by Jess Zeidman, and our theme song is All Fired Up by the band Tra La La. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Hi, I'm Jen Jacobs, the owner and baker at Wandering Whisk Bake Shop in St. Pete, Florida. Do you want to know who I think is the bomb? Molly Yeh. She's not only a cookbook author and an award-winning food blogger, but she has her own Food Network show, Girl Meets Farm. After long days around sugar, I love making Molly savory recipes that are a mix of her Chinese and Jewish heritage. Plus, I found someone that's as crazy about sprinkles as I am.